I'm here to introduce Vicky Beeching. She is a... yes, appropriate. She is a theologian, writer and broadcaster, for those of you that didn't know. She is regularly on Sky News, the BBC and many radio stations. She also writes for The Guardian Independent. On top of that, she's kind of a big deal in the online world. If you don't follow her on Twitter, at Vicky Beeching, I'd highly recommend you do. She's been considering the relationship between technology and spirituality, and the Twitter place is a sort of community where there's debate, and you can be part of that. She blogs a lot at vickybeeching.com on topics that she's not afraid to speak about and tackles it head on. Because of this, she's had some pretty horrible trolling, which she'll touch on in this session. Recently, just a couple, last week, she launched a new project called feminisminfaith.com, which is all about the relationship between feminism and faith. Can they sit together? Can they not? And exploring it from different perspectives and from different religions. So, now, without further ado, please give a very, very warm Greenbelt welcome to Vicky Beeching.
Firstly, thank you for coming. Make sure my mic's good. Everybody at the back, able to hear, wave a hand, show me you're alive. Yeah, show me you're alive. Are you alive? You are alive. You look a bit dead, but no. I really appreciate you coming. As you can imagine, having a session like this is a bit like putting on a party, and you wonder if anyone's actually going to show up. So I'm always really relieved to actually see anybody's come to hear. Just to prove that we are not all geeks with no social skills, I want you to just turn to the people around you and say hello. Share your name, maybe just two or three people you don't know, just to say hello and why you're interested in technology. Fantastic. There you go, you've made some new friends. Well, most people start their sessions by saying, I'd really like you to switch off your phones. But I'd like to do the opposite and say, I'd love you to switch on your phones, tablets, devices, whatever you've got with you, if you get any reception here in this middle of nowhere field. Obviously, it'd be great if you had them on silent, but I'd encourage you to engage in tweeting, Facebooking, whatever you're into online as we are in this session, and expanding the conversation beyond the physical to the virtual. I think it's a win-win situation for you because, frankly, if you get bored, you can be playing Angry Birds. And I will think that you're really engaging your online communities in what I'm saying. So it's a win-win. So, you know, tweet away. The title of today's session is Being Real in a Virtual World. And I want to explore the point in history in which we find ourselves technologically, how the world around us is reacting to that, and the kind of messages we're being given by the media, by commentators, by people in the street, what kind of advice we should be listening to, what kind of advice we shouldn't be listening to, and then where the church fits into all of that. So it'll be a bit of a whistle-stop tour. But I'll start off by asking you this. Have you ever wondered what it might be like to work in an IT call centre day in, day out? Is anybody lucky enough to do that here? If you do, much respect. Sometimes I wonder, as I call these places with my own griefs about gadgets, what must it be like to listen to the kind of stuff that people phone up with? I discovered a few. An exasperated caller to the Dell support hotline rang up, unable to get her new machine to work. After ensuring that the computer was in fact turned on, the technician said to the lady, "What happens when you press the main power button?" Her response was, "Well, I don't know anything about a power button. I've been trying with the foot pedal. I've been stamping on it for hours, but to no avail." It turned out the foot pedal was the mouse. How awesome is that? Like, I'm never going to look at a mouse in the same way. Another customer phoned up the IBM hotline and said, "I've had a few problems inserting my software disks. It said put in disk one. I put in disk one. It said put in disk two. I tried really hard, got it in there. When it said put in disk three, there was no more room in the slot." Here's one for the Apple fans. Apparently, they say, if you play a Microsoft installation CD backwards, you hear satanic messages. But that's nothing. If you play it forwards, it installs Windows. More jokes later. This is my wannabe comic stand-up, you know, career that was obviously stunted because I'm not actually funny. So, the virtual world and online technology. This is my favourite topic to speak about. It's become a really popular topic now, but back in the day, about 7 or 8 years ago, when I spoke about it in the States, I would announce my seminar titles and people would meet me with a quizzical expression, and then they'd say really polite things like, "That's a really niche area." I'd be like, "Thanks. Brackets, no one's going to come to your session." But it's great to see such an interest now, isn't it, in social media, that we can all be in this room wanting to discuss it and debate it. Academic institutions are popping up to give it research. And I think it's an exciting time to be alive. We've got this new thing, and we're all figuring out in real time how on earth we use it. My own journey with it started 10 years ago in America. I've almost lost my American accent. If you hear any American, just wave a hand and go, "No!" I'm trying really hard. I used to say "y'all" for a while because I lived in Nashville, which is just awful, isn't it? It's happened to me. But when I lived over there, I was there at a really interesting time. Social networking was just beginning as a grassroots movement. In 2003, we saw the monumental rise of MySpace. May it now rest in peace. Anybody still love MySpace? It'd be awesome if there was just one person. MySpace started in 2003, and then the blogging platform WordPress. Anybody use WordPress? That launched in 2003 as well. Facebook in 2004, and Twitter in 2006. So if you look at that kind of historically, it's like a sudden rush of new inventions popping up. And I lived near Los Angeles, and it was exciting to see these things beginning to gain traction and take hold. I, as a total geek, happy to sacrifice my non-existent social life, was more than happy to sit in coffee shops and learn the ropes of all these technologies. And soon I had about 20,000 MySpace friends. And you can really see what benefit that has for me now. One of the other elements of my job in the States involved music and a lot of traveling. So everywhere I went across America, I would ask people questions. How are you getting on with these new technologies? What do you think of them? And I would have informal interview conversations, especially with churches. And I'd say to these American churches, "What do you think of social media? What are you saying to your congregations about it? How are you involving it in your church life?" And I got the chance to kind of gauge a lot of the temperature of how America was responding to all this stuff. It became so interesting to me that when I came back here to England 2 years ago, I decided to do a PhD in it. So I'm doing a part-time doctorate at the University of Durham, where I'm exploring all of these things. And again, that means I have no social life. I don't know if you're a words person. I love Scrabble and Boggle and those kind of quite sad pastimes. And I even read the dictionary every now and then. But I love paying close attention to words that are used about things. So when we describe things, we have a kind of suitcase, don't we, of words. And it's very interesting to see what words we go for when we want to describe things. And the words we use, they kind of unveil the foundational beliefs that we hold about something. And that's true of technology. So when I hear technology discussed, whether it's at the pub or on the news or in the newspapers, I always look at the words that people use. And it's a very interesting pastime if you start doing it. If you pay attention to the words that are used about technology at the moment in media and commentary, what you will see is a very subtle underlying negative bias. It's just my opinion, and I know a lot of people do feel it as well, but a kind of growing negativity that's popping up in the wording that we see used. And I lovingly call that techno-panic. So where is this techno-panic? Well, headlines have become commonplace recently. Things like, "Social websites harm children's brains," "Twitter and Facebook are ruining a generation," "Online networking harms your health." I'd also quite like to be a voiceover artist if I don't really work as a speaker, so. If you look in bookshops as well, you're likely to see this techno panic in the language. One particular title I love is this: iPod, iPad, eye disorder, understanding your obsession with technology and breaking its hold over you. It's my tribute to the charismatics among you. Breaking it off you. Another one: virtually you, the dangers of the e-personality. And finally, my absolute favourite: digital invasion, how technology is shaping you and your world. I mean, we look at those and actually, they don't actually seem that weird. They are literally quite popular, those sort of headlines, you know. cyber wars are raging, you know, trolls are taking over the world. And we might just think, oh, that's trying to, you know, people trying to sell a newspaper or sell a book. But if you look at the wording being used, it's actually full of techno panic. Even that last one, digital invasion, is so telling. Firstly, it uses military language. It's not just that technology is a presence, it's an invasion, it's sweeping in. It's like Armageddon, we're just decimated by the alien invaders. If you look at Nicholas Carr, has anybody read The Shallows? It's quite a popular, it's a bestseller, and the title of it is The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. And this best-selling book argues that the internet is basically leading us into the shallows, this kind of regression, this childlike pool where we're all becoming complete idiots. So these negative biases we see about invasions, about the internet doing things to us, actually attribute a strange kind of personification to the technology. We don't see it as just a tool in our hands. The internet's actually become a thing that's doing something to us. You know, literally, the World Wide Web is like an alien wrestling me to the ground in a pool of blood. And that is the assumption underneath these titles. And yet, if we don't unpack what they're actually saying, we can look at it on the surface and go, yes, the digital invasion is ruining my life. But actually, it's crazy. One of the problems that happens when we have this negative view of technology is that then bad things happen, and it kind of exacerbates the negativity yet further. Did many of you hear about the tragic suicide of Hannah Smith, the Ask FM teenager? That was a terrible situation. And the fact that it was so emotive led to even more of this kind of techno panic. If you look at something as neutral and something bad happens, you respond in one way. But if you're looking at something as already bad and something bad happens, it becomes really bad. So as soon as the news reported on Hannah Smith, the kind of sweep of opinion was, right, social networking is evil. Anonymity is always wrong. Ask FM and other sites like it should be shut down overnight. The other interesting cameo was David Cameron. He popped up and he said, well, I've got the solution here for you chaps. Everybody needs to just get their children off the internet. And I know that sounds funny, but that actually is what he said. Much respect to David Cameron as the leader of this nation, but he really did say that. He said, there is a solution to this problem. He said, parents, all you need to do is boycott. Take your children off these sites, switch them off. That really was his advice. And I hate disrespecting anybody, but I have to say, I think that's not very good advice. Basically, we saw a sweep of opinion saying bad things have happened and technology is to blame. We're going to point the finger at the websites, at the technology, instead of maybe, I think, where the blame really lies. But I'll get onto that in a moment. Another situation that's instilled techno panic in people is the recent trolling of female journalists, MPs, and campaigners. Anybody notice that in the news? One of the funny things that happened to me was I actually ended up standing in the middle of London wearing a red cape and holding a sword and a shield, dressed up as Boadicea. Now, I don't quite know how this happened, but the picture made it into almost every broadsheet newspaper, which makes me sure that it really did actually happen. A friend of mine, Caroline Criado Perez, is a feminist campaigner, and she decided she wanted to take on the Bank of England. The Bank of England had announced that they would be replacing the only female face left on our banknotes, other than the Queen, who doesn't count because she's just the Queen. Like, you know, she'd be the Queen if she was... Well, she'd be the King, wouldn't she? She's basically there regardless of gender. So the only person on a banknote who was there for their achievement, not as the monarch, was going to be replaced from the notes. My friend Caroline was just appalled by this. She thought, you know, we're handing money around all day. It's our currency. It says something about what we respect. We need to have women's faces on these notes. And so she started a petition. And within a very, very short amount of time, we had 33,000 signatures spread through social media saying, yes, we need to keep the faces of women on our banknotes. So she called me and she said, I've got these petitions done. We're going to take the petitions to the Bank of England. I want you to come with me. There's going to be four of us presenting the boxes to the bank, but I need you to dress up as Boadicea. I was like, I think I might be busy. So I did it. And the awkward thing was, I was there early. And it was so awkward. No one else had arrived yet. And I literally came out of the tube. I was like, with my shield and sword. I was like, and kind of was standing there. If you've been to the Bank tube station, there's this giant memorial of this big horse. And I was just standing under the horse going, where is everyone? And a policeman came up to me and he said, are you all right? I said, I'm part of a massive campaign. It was really embarrassing. Anyway, they did finally show up, not in quite as dramatic as attire as me, which also was a bit awkward, but I just thought I'd really go for it, you know? I went to the fancy dress shop and spent 50 quid and, you know. Anyway, after I'd recovered from all that trauma, it was great news because the Bank of England said they would put a woman on the banknote. Did anybody know that? Jane Austen's going to be on the next £10 note, which is fantastic. And we were excited, but then out of nowhere came this wave of trolling online, this vicious attack and abuse, mainly aimed at Caroline, who was getting 50 rape threats an hour. And having looked at her at replies, the kind of violent things they were describing wanting to do to her just would have made your blood boil or made you just terrified if you're a woman who feels vulnerable. So it then involved the police, and then other people like Stella Creasy, the MP, Mary Beard, the academic, were also getting trolled. And it really hit the media attention. A couple of others, I think Catelyn Moran and a few other people got bomb threats. And it just kind of spiraled out of control. Trolling was in the headlines. Now, I was really grateful for all the support the public showed, being someone who was receiving the trolling. But with my researcher hat on, I was also paying attention to the words that were being used. And I have to say, yet more techno panic. Looking at technology and going, this is the problem. You know, social networking is creating trolls. Anonymity is causing this bullying. You know, headlines in magazines like, you know, Twitter is a playground of evil. Anybody felt like that? See? So we look at these situations and basically we see language used that belies the underlying feeling that technology is biased towards being bad. So then when bad things happen, it just exacerbates it and suddenly people are just going, whoa, shut the thing down, it's Pandora's box, close it, put it away, it's not there, there is no box, la la la. One final example I'll give you of techno panic in the media was around the recent invention of the test tube grown beef burger. Anybody familiar with that? So they made a burger, they grew it out of stem cells, genetically modified, and if you saw it on the telly, there was a picture of a food critic munching away on it going, it's not particularly juicy, but it's okay. And when it was reported in the news, I was thinking, fantastic, you know, technology moves forwards. We could solve the problems of cruelty against animals. Maybe we could feed the growing population of the world that need meat. Maybe vegetarians would have, you know, a solution to the summer barbecue crisis when you just smell that food, but you know that the thing's been, you know, treated cruelly. Would you eat a burger if you were a vegetarian and it wasn't produced cruelly? Is there anybody that would actually cross that line? See, there you go. This could be for you. But, you know, this burger potentially, it could be a really exciting step forward. But what was the main headline about it? Frankenburger. I was like, this is going in my seminar. So, you know, this burger is described as, comparable to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. This is alien creature that's going to just rise up out of the bun and kill us all. Frankenburger, if that is not a sign of techno panic, I don't know what is. I've argued this several times. I actually argued about the Frankenburger on a BBC One programme 2 weeks ago, and I compared it to IVF. I said when IVF, you know, in vitro fertilisation first came along, we thought it was very frightening, but now it's actually become quite a normal option for lots of couples. We've become accustomed to things. So they start off as techno-panic, and then we try them out, we realise they're actually okay, and then they become normal. So honestly, I think before we all die, we will be eating on a regular basis the Frankenburger. When I was a child, there was this favourite story that I loved my mum reading to me. It was about Lionel the Lion. Oh, Lionel the Lion was a really great lion, and he really wanted lots of friends. But things were tough for him because he'd kind of grown up with lots of lions, and then he realised he wanted to kind of like, you know, spread his horizons a bit, meet a few other different creatures. And so he was still young, and he made his way out of the kind of lion pack in the jungle to meet some other animals. And he was quite disappointed because every time he kind of strolled up to say hi, they'd go, "Whoa!" and run away. because he was a lion. And he didn't know that, because he was a good bloke. And basically, he became aware that the whole of his society had a negative bias towards lions. So he could just stroll up, you know, casual as anything, "What up, dude?" And they would just scarper, because they had an inbuilt assumption that lions were bad. Now, one day, Lionel saw a little deer that looked a bit like Bambi lying in a crossing in the jungle, and he walked up to this little deer, and he said, "I really want to help you. I can see that your leg's been stuck in a trap, you're covered in blood. I'm going to help carry you off to a safe place." You know where this is going, don't you? Then suddenly, lots of other animals came onto the scene, and what did they see? Lionel the lion, Bambi the deer, deer in mouth, blood on leg. End of the story. Lionel the lion was killed. I know. He actually didn't die, which is why the story did get better and why I liked it as a child. But for the purposes of this session, that really says a lot to me about our assumptions. When we come upon something and we take a look at it, it's very easy, if we've already got negative assumptions, to believe the worst. So Lionel, you know, good lion, friendly, wants friends, everybody thinks he's bad. You know, you come upon a situation where he's doing something good, but with the negative overlay, we assume the worst. And I see that happening so much with technology. All of these bad situations that happen, you know, trolling or suicides or the invention of new foods or processes that scare us, we come onto this scene and we see something and we make a judgment based on an already negative overlay as a society, and we say, trolling, right, that's the fault of anonymity, that's the fault of social media, or weird food made in a test tube, that's going to take us over and kill us. What we actually need to do is unmask the negative bias that we've already put on these technologies and look at them again and say, actually, trolling, yes, it's a bad situation, but what's actually at work here? What is actually to blame? And unless we're pointing at the right thing as the culprit, we're not going to find a solution. Agree with me? So there's two ways I think we do this with our techno panic. Either we blame it massively, or the other extreme is that we actually dismiss it as nothing. And both of them are a response to panic. We either say, whoa, this thing's awful, and we're going to take it on, head on, and fight it. Or we say, there is no terrible lion in front of me, I'm just going to ignore it. And I call that ignoring, techno-dismissal. And you'll also find that in the media. Has anybody ever been told that being online is not real life? Happens a lot if you're a geek and you spend a lot of time on social media. You get people coming up to you going, so, do you get out much? Do you have any real friends? You really should invest more in, you know, your real community. And that kind of language, again, very common, wouldn't you say? We see it a lot, and I think that's another form of techno-panic. Instead of fighting and blaming, it's dismissing and minimizing the kind of, there is no lion, look away, like, it's not real. And that is what I see demonstrated in David Cameron's comments, that we can just switch it off, we can walk away, we can pretend it's not there, it's not important, our teenagers don't need this technology, it doesn't really mean anything. And dismissing it like that is actually also very, very dangerous. Because if you dismiss something that is there, it's still there and the problem remains. Even the general manager of Twitter was guilty of this recently. His name's Tony Wang, and he was speaking about the trolling of women. And he made a public apology, and he said this. I personally apologize to the women who have experienced abuse on Twitter. The abuse they've received is not acceptable in the real world, and it's not acceptable on Twitter. And I was like, hang on a minute, you're the general manager of Twitter. That's a bit weird. Because it is real, because like that's your full-time job. And I hope you think it's real, because if you don't, then we look a bit stupid, because I spend like most of my life on there, to be honest. So that was quite shocking to me, I think, that this dismissal of the technology is almost as dangerous as the blaming and the fear up front, that we say, actually, we don't really want to engage in this place. It's not real, we don't need it, and we can just switch it off. Neither of them are a solution, and if we look to either the blaming or the dismissing, we're actually not going to get anywhere, and we're not going to fix the massive problems that we face as a society. You're listening well, so joke break. Okay, online dating. Here's an example of online dating gone wrong. A bachelor visited a dating website It asked him to enter in the details of the companion he wanted to find. He said, "Well, I'd like a companion who is small, cute, loves water sports, and enjoys group activities." And the computer came back saying, "Marry a penguin." Here's one at my own expense. How do you know if a blonde has been using your laptop? It's covered in Tippex. Finally, another joke for Apple fans out there. Computers are a bit like air conditioning. They stop working as soon as you open Windows. Yeah, I shouldn't give up the day job, should I really? Seeing technology as the enemy is not new. It's actually something that's happened to every generation. So it's just so important for us not to fall into those old patterns and just do what keeps happening year after year, century after century, because we want to be making progress, don't we? We don't just want to be slipping into predictable patterns. If you look back into the 1500s, when the printing press was invented, a respected Swiss scientist, Conrad Gessner, said it would create a modern world overwhelmed with data. He said the overabundance would be confusing and harmful to the mind. Even back in ancient times, Socrates warned against writing. I love that. He said, "Writing will create forgetfulness in the learner's souls because they will forget to use their memories." So writing is incredibly harmful, as is the printing press. In the 18th century, people worried that newspapers were gaining popularity. A French statesman wrote that getting news from the printed page would socially isolate us. It would ruin the spiritually uplifting practice of looking to the Lord and of getting news from the church pulpit. Does anybody wish that they were, any vicars here, you wish that you actually were in control of people's news feed? Used to have a lot of power, still do, but, you know, the newspaper has apparently ruined you. We saw the same thing 100 years later when schooling became common. Education was labelled unnatural. Apparently it posed a risk to mental health. In an 1883 medical journal, it said that schools exhaust children's brains and nervous systems with complex and multiple studies, and they ruin their bodies by protracted imprisonment. I'm sure we can all relate to that. It was also widely believed by the medical world at that time that excessive study was a major cause of madness. I won't make any comment about my PhD friends. This techno panic was only increased when the radio came along, as you can imagine. It was said to distract children from reading and reduce their performance at school. Bizarrely, of course, by that time, reading and going to school had become very normal and celebrated. But now the radio was the problem and the threat to those. A 1936 music magazine contained a worried article saying that children had developed the habit of dividing attention between their school assignments and the compelling excitement of the radio's loudspeaker. And apparently the radio programs were disturbing the balance of their excitable minds. Television arrived, as you can imagine. Gosh, what would they make of that? Historian Ellen Wartella wrote about it, saying back then, opponents voiced concerns about TV would hurt conversation, reading, the pattern of family living, and result in the vulgarization of culture. So here we are, vulgarized. Fast forwarding to the end of the 20th century, it's more interesting to look back, isn't it? We can laugh, we can say, how ridiculous to think that writing and, you know, going to school and listening to the radio or the gramophone could create such panic, but it did. And the more we can take that on board, the more we can apply that to our situation today. So we look now at the end of the 20th century, you know, our homes are full of computers. The World Wide Web is gaining massive ground. And we read articles in things like CNN, who reported that email hurts your IQ more than pot. No comment on that one. The Telegraph says Twitter and Facebook could totally harm moral values, and the MySpace generation cannot form relationships. The Daily Mail even ran a piece saying how using Facebook could increase your risk of cancer. So Douglas Adams, a writer, has sort of drawn from all of this the conclusion that technologies that exist when we're born seem very normal to us. Anything that's developed before we turn 35 is exciting. And anything after that is just the devil. So it's interesting, isn't it, to look back at the comments that were made about technology through the ages, to laugh at them and go, "Ho, ho, ho, you're so foolish." And then we find ourselves talking about the Frankenburger. going, ooh, hang on a minute, there's some similarities here. Whatever is new is scary. Each new development has to pass through phases to show itself to be safe, and as it passes through those stages, it has bumps and bruises. So I like to think of social media as, well, it's 10 now, basically, in its, you know, kind of modern form. Twitter just turned 10. I like to think of it as being in its infancy, in its childhood, and about to go into its awkward, gangly teenage phase. So everyone knows in childhood you do have bumps and bruises. You're finding out who you are. And there's a patience, hopefully, for children as they go through those phases. So we need to be patient with these technologies. When people around you are techno-panicking, it's great to just remind them, you know, give this some time. This is all so new. 10 years ago, we didn't even know what a tweet was. You know, it was the thing, the bird on the roof that you wanted to shoot because it was so loud. Or was that just me? Technology is so new, and we're finding our feet, and we have to give it grace because it is in its childhood. It's about to go into its awkward teenage years. Who knows what that means? Usually bad news, isn't it? I was quite an obnoxious teenager. So what's social media going to be like for the next 10 years? What are we going to have to deal with? And are we ready to remember that it's actually not the technology that's to blame, it's the way we use it? Now, Greenbelt's a Christian festival. Anybody here call themselves Christian? Anybody wondering about retracting their membership? Just kidding. I think it's important to talk about the way technology and church intersect. Have you ever tried tweeting in church? I have many times and only just about lived to tell the tale. I had one particular incident when I was visiting a church in London. I'm still sort of searching for a church home there. And I was in the back and I thought, well, nobody's really watching. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to do what I do. I love sharing things virtually. I thought, I want to tweet a quote from that sermon. I want to tweet maybe the piece. Maybe I could virtually share the piece in the Anglican liturgy over, you know, over the airwaves or whatever you call them now. Basically, as I got out my phone, this woman descended upon me who literally must have been about 150 years old. She looked a bit like something from Jurassic Park, and she kind of like swung in, and there was this icy finger on my shoulder, and I looked up, and there was this thick moustache and these beady eyes. And she said, "We don't do that sort of thing in here." And I thought, oh, don't you? How embarrassing. Everybody's looking at me. I put it away. And I've tried it about, I would say, about 50 times in different churches over the last year. I usually try and do it every Sunday if I can, but when women like that spook out on me, it, you know, puts me off for a week. I like to log the reactions I get in different churches, and whether it's morning or evening, whether it's a cathedral or a small church. I found there's usually one person in the room, and it's probably one of you guys, when I get out my phone in church, there's that moment of locking eyes, that kind of, yeah, yeah, you're on the same page. I've got my Samsung, you've got your iPhone 5. We're way ahead of all these people, aren't we? There's like one person in the congregation who's like the cool kind of techie person. And then there's like 90 other old people that go, So wherever you are planted in the Lord's garden, be that person. Be that person. But the attitudes within the church matter towards technology. And it is a bit of a joke, you know, tweeting in church. But again, like with the unpacking of language, actually it says a lot when you begin to kind of unpack what that actually means on a deeper level. So, you know, 150-year-old mustachioed church warden lady with hand on shoulder, you know, actually underneath that are some interesting attitudes about what the church thinks about technology. Now, this room is not in any way representative. So we're obviously, you know, interested in discussing and embracing this. But overall, from all my informal interviews among Christians, I found some interesting attitudes. One particular project I did was around Lent. Everybody know what Lent is? It's funny, I speak to a lot of people that don't. So, but it's basically a time when you fast from things in the Christian calendar, when you give things up to prepare for Easter. And I did a little survey, and I found lots and lots of Christians told me with eager and earnest faces, "I'm giving up Facebook for Lent." And it's not a disrespect to anyone in this room that did, at all. Lots of people had a profile picture that said, "Off Facebook for Lent." And I thought, that's interesting. I wonder what that means. You know, for some people, that's actually a really good thing. They're just thinking, you know what? I just don't want to be on Facebook for Lent. But for a lot of people that I did interview on this, there were some really interesting answers. One of them said to me, God deserves all my attention. Somebody else said, I need to purify myself from the worldly ways of the internet. Others said, I really need to spend time with my real friends. As you can see all the words that wind me up now, can't you? It's brilliant. So there were very few references in those conversations to the good things that social media could actually bring. And a lot of negativity, a kind of strange attitude. I think one of the main things I picked up was that to them, Facebook was a bit like smoking. It was something that you desperately needed to be delivered from, but you couldn't quite manage it. So you sort of had to put it down for a while and like run away and go, help me. So coming off Facebook for Lent for them was a way of saying, I'm stepping away from something bad and I'm going to focus on something good. I'm stepping away from something false to focus on the real. I'm stepping away from the unspiritual to focus on the spiritual. And I think that is a broken distinction, a broken binary, a wrong dualism that should not be there. Another informal study that I did was about social media within church again. And I asked people, I said, what have your experiences been? Is it just me that gets ambushed by old ladies in the back of church when I get out my phone? And a lot of people said, no, we actually don't want to tweet in church. I said, oh, tell me about that. And they said, well, we feel like it's a holy time. We feel like church is a place of worship. It would be completely inappropriate to be fiddling around on smartphones when God deserves our full attention. And I thought, interesting. A sort of feeling in the church, a bias, as I would say in society, to think of technology as something negative, as something inappropriate for a holy place. Using words like distracting, addictive. Somehow this thing is not compatible with a holy God and with a time of honouring a holy God. Now, thankfully, not everybody thinks like that because you guys are here. And there are many exciting signs. There's a fantastic communications director for the Church of England who's relatively new in his post. His name's Aaron Arora, and he's worth following on Twitter if you don't already. But Aaron wants to see the Church of England embrace all the good stuff that technology has to offer. And I love my conversations with him because I think that's the direction we need to be heading in. Technology is not unholy. Technology is not rebellion against God. Technology is a gift. It's a tool in our hands, and we get to choose how we use it. My belief is actually that the church should be leading the way in technology. I think there is a prophetic dimension to technology that meshes so perfectly with us as prophetic people. And I think God has plans for it, and there's no reason why we should be on the front end of it rather than bringing up the rear. Most people's assumptions about the church and new things are bad, aren't they? You know, it's like when we got screens at the front. Oh, we got a lovely screen. People are like, that is so like 1980. You know, I mean, we're not known, are we, for being the most adept when it comes to technology. We're lucky if we've got a working PA system. And that's not a problem, but it's just a reputation I think the church has that maybe we don't really embrace new things very well. But I think we should be on the very front of it. Is technology prophetic, you might ask? I think it is. I think technology is inherently a pushing at the boundaries of what is possible. It's peering into the future. It's like we're pilgrims on a journey for connectivity and meaning. I think information itself actually has religious overtones, a kind of modern-day Gnosticism. Expertise now for all of us is just a click away. It's become quite religious. I even think sometimes of the way that we sit in front of our machines, staring into the screens, our eyes moving and looking at the text, our fingers moving over the keys. And I wonder if it's a sort of modern-day form of meditation and praying. It seems comparable to me like praying the rosary. Instead of our fingers moving over the beads, they're moving over the keys as we focus, we search, we gaze. The screens we look at could even be compared to portals. We stare into them, and they even reflect our image back if we catch them at the right angle, like a mirror, maybe a black mirror, as per Charlie Brooker. It reminds me of the magic mirrors in fairy tales, where people stared into them, saying, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? We look into our laptops, we look into our smartphones, and in some way we're saying, who am I? Am I beautiful? Do I mean something? Where do I fit? Our technology is spiritual. It hums and it buzzes, not just with electricity, but with a prophetic dimension of people searching for something out there. So in my opinion, it's very religious, it's very prophetic, and it meshes well with the people of a prophetic religion. Why shouldn't we be the people that ask God to help us see where this thing's going? It taps into the spiritual core of who we are, meaning, identity, purpose. All of this stuff is very relevant to the church, isn't it? And yet somehow those negative biases have led us to believe that this is a rebellion against God, this is unholy, this is something to keep out of church. My belief is it's something very much for us to embrace. Church can be quite boring, can't it? Come on, can't it? Yes, you're all a greenbelt going, I wish my church was like greenbelt, this is so good, got to go back. You know, there's that 150-year-old woman with a moustache who runs the church and the bad PA system. And, you know, greenbelt is a chance for us to go, wow, you know, there's so many great people out there, great speakers, great bands. And then often you can go home and kind of go, eek. But one of the things I think is that church needs to mirror the internet in its collaboration. I speak about this a lot, calling it Church 2.0. Now, who knows what Web 1.0 was? Anybody feel like they could explain that? Web 1.0 was the first installment, as it were, of the internet. Basically, the internet was static and non-participatory. You'd look at a web page, you couldn't really do much with it, there wasn't really any interaction. And then Web 2.0 came along, and it was the world of social networking, where suddenly we could engage, we could interact, we could play our part. If you compare the Web 1.0 and Web 2.0 model to church, what do you get? Are our churches 1.0? Are they static and non-participatory? Or are they 2.0, where every user gets to shape the experience, create the environment, and make a different service because they were in that seat? Sometimes I look at church and I think it's very 1.0. It's typically one person standing up the front, saying something to a bunch of people who are just sitting there. And maybe the most you get to do is read off a sheet or sing a song. Now, my dream for this is for Church 2.0, so that a generation of young people who have been raised with digital technology as the norm, they can come into the church and not feel like it's an alien culture. What would it look like if our churches actually functioned in a 2.0 manner, where everybody got to contribute, to speak, to ask questions, to lead, where it wasn't all about experts? It requires a lot of us taking our hands off the controls. But I think if we don't make our churches a little bit more 2.0, we might actually not capture a digital generation. Some food for thought that you can take home and annoy your pastors with. Okay, so it's all very 1.0. It's like so totally last season, dude. Theologically, there are some really interesting things that I'd love to recommend you look at if you want to discover more about this. I wish we had more time. We don't have very long left. But if you want to explore the negative bias that underlies technology, I'd recommend you read a guy called Jacques Ellul. He's French. His last name is E-L-L-U-L, Jacques Ellul. And he's a very influential thinker on technology. He is one of the prime arguers that technology is an invading army, that it's marching in boots and stomping all over us, that it's taking away our freedom, that it's making us hypnotized in an ocean of information where we can't think for ourselves. So Jacques Ellul is a great person to read. He's got a really monumental book called The Technological Society. And he kind of is largely responsible, I think, for a lot of the negative attitudes that we see. A lot of my PhD work is actually focused on finding a solution theologically for how we as the church can see technology in a positive light. And in combat to people like Jacques Ellul, the theologian I've landed on as someone who I think can provide a framework for a positive theology of technology is another French man called Théard de Chardin. I won't spell it for you, but he's a brilliant thinker. He was a paleontologist, very interested in excavations, and often found kind of, you know, scrabbling around for fossils and things, as people like that do. My dad's into that. Basically, Théard de Chardin was a paleontologist fascinated by Charles Darwin and evolutionary theory, and he was also a Jesuit priest. So he brought his evolutionary biology, his paleontology, and his theology together, and he came up with a framework that I think gives us a positive theology for our technology. If you want to read his work, I'd recommend you start with The Phenomenon of Man. The Phenomenon of Man is one of his major works by Teilhard de Chardin. And he basically argues that God began this evolutionary process, that it's moving forwards at a great rate, and that evolution has kind of found its pinnacle in the physical form of the human race, and that now its work is actually more occupied with the mind, with consciousness. So evolution continues, but it's more of an evolution of consciousness, about connecting us in the way we communicate and think. Now, he lived quite a long time ago, but he predicted that at some point, consciousness would develop so that the Earth would be covered by a thinking envelope, a kind of buzzing envelope of thought and energy and consciousness. And if you read his work on it, it's really not difficult to link that up with the concept of the internet, of social media, of this kind of thought layer that's surrounding the Earth as all of our minds think and communicate and talk to one another. Now, he saw us moving forwards in the direction of this complexity and this consciousness to the point where we will one day be united with God. And his thought is very comparable to the concept in the Bible, you know, of us meeting Christ in the air, being united with him, and spending eternity together. So it's this kind of trajectory that technology isn't, as Jacques Ellul would say, rebelling against God, the army marching in with boots and stealing us away from loving God. In fact, in Teilhard de Chardin's thought, it's actually God at work himself. He's actually skilling us, making us intelligent, giving us the smart that we need to invent all of these gadgets, helping us to communicate more, turning this physical earth also into a conscious community of people that can communicate rapidly and share thought and be united as a result. You've probably heard the concept of the global village, and that very much ties in again with Teilhard de Chardin's work, this concept that the more we can communicate, the faster we can communicate, the more united we are. So read about him, Teilhard de Chardin, the phenomenon of man, and his idea that we are on this positive trajectory, and actually that to work with God in this context is to embrace technology, to see the good in it, to see the forward motion. I think we'd all agree that we're better people, hopefully, for having writing, schooling, electricity, things like that. We can work with the purposes of God. Obviously, progress and, all progress is not good. I'm not saying that. That's a pretty flawed argument. But specifically in the field of technology, we can actually see it as God making us the fullness of who he wants us to be, actually developing us into people who know him better, who know each other better, who are more conscious, more able to communicate. So I would just encourage you to look at the positive theological thinkers and writers on technology, as well as the bad ones, and to go a bit deeper into this stuff, because it really helps you unmask what you read when Frankenberger crops up on the news. I do really wish we had more positive headlines about technology, but unfortunately they never really grab us in quite the same way. You know, you might look at the front page of the Daily Mail and see something like, I got to speak to my granny 10 minutes before she died, thanks to the power of Skype. It's not going to be there, is it? It's going to be Frankenberger and the takeover of the trolls. So positive news doesn't really get out there. And I would encourage you, as people who I hope are passionate about technology, to be spreaders of good messages about technology in your communities, with your friends, to try and change that thinking, those negative underlying assumptions. If you know people that are quite skeptical of technology, maybe in your churches, tell stories about the great things that happen. Tell stories about the Women on Banknotes campaign that, through a viral petition on social media, women now will actually be on our currency rather than not. Or the different startups and charities like To Write Love on Her Arms, the anti-suicide movement that started on MySpace and now is a global phenomenon recognised by Rolling Stone magazine. It's these small things that start online and they spread like wildfire, and so much good can happen. I bet many of you actually found out about Greenbelt online. I wouldn't be surprised at all. Lots of people on Twitter I've seen over the last few weeks saying, I am going to go to Greenbelt. I've seen tweets about it. It's been recommended to me by my Facebook friends. So much good can happen online, and I encourage you to really encourage the people around you to embrace it. One final thought that I'll leave you with. Any Harry Potter fans in the room? I've talked about a lot of things. I've talked about techno panic, The fact that we can enter into blame culture, where the technology is the problem. I've talked about techno dismissal, where in our panic we can minimise and say, actually, this thing isn't real. It's not real life. It doesn't mean anything. We can just switch it off and it'll go away. Those are two attitudes I'd love to see combated in the media and in the public. I've talked to you about where some of those negative attitudes come from. People like Jacques Ellul talking about technology marching in like an army. I've talked about positive options that we can look to. People like Teilhard de Chardin and his evolutionary theory of God at work. But if you take away one thing today, it would be this. Simply the reiteration that technology is a tool. It's not the enemy. It is a tool in our hands. All the while we point at the tool as the problem, we fail to point the finger in the direction we need to be pointing it at, which is at ourselves. Unless we deal with the great responsibility that comes from these tools and we rise up to meet that ethically and morally, we're not going to fix it. Technology is a tool. We can look into it for many different reasons. And I'll leave you with one scene from Harry Potter. So Harry is looking into a mirror. Anybody seen Harry Potter? What a great series of movies. I'm such a Harry Potter geek. Has anyone been to the Harry Potter world? I want to go so badly. I want one of those wands so I can just, you know, yeah, it's going to be great. Harry Potter is looking into this mirror, and Dumbledore comes along and says to him, Harry, you've discovered the mirror of Erised. Erised is desire, spelt backwards. Shows how much of a Harry Potter geek I am. The mirror of Erised will show you the deepest desires of your heart. You gaze into it, and it reflects back to you what you want. And he tells Harry, this mirror is an opportunity as you look into it to see what it is that drives you, to see your reasoning for the things you're pursuing in life. And it gives you a chance to decide, should I continue to pursue these things or should I not? And Harry looks into it and he realizes what he's seeing in the mirror is something he can never have. But he begins to spend hours and hours watching it, staying there, sitting by it. Dumbledore says to him, you've got to stop coming to this mirror, Harry, because the things you're looking for in there are not going to happen. It's an escapism. You've got to use this mirror for good. You've got to look into it, realize you need to change the direction of your desires in your life, get out of here and live. And I think screens and technology give us that same moment, that mirror of Erised choice, where we gaze into them and we get to say, why am I spending all this time online? What desires here are driving me? Am I using this as escapism or am I using this as a tool to actually help the whole of my life? And it's worth asking that question as people who love technology. As we remember it's just a tool, we personally can use it also for good or for harm. We can use it as escapism to switch off from the rest of the world, or we can actually use it for positive, for spiritual reasons, for connecting with people on a deeper level. So I just encourage you as a thought to consider why you spend lots of time online and to make sure that we start with us, because that's the solution, isn't it? The solution is the tool needs to be used well. We start with ourselves saying, why am I using this technology? How am I using it? Why am I spending the time I am on it? And is it good? So look for techno-blaming in the media. See it, expose it, the Frankenberger headlines, and spread the message that online really is real and not real. And my passionate ending to you would be a plea that we start to think how we as a society can rise to the challenge of using these technologies. As Spider-Man once said, with great power comes great responsibility. We have these amazing tools in our hands. The choice is now up to us. Can we use them responsibly or not? And we need to be the change. Thank you.